Open your Bibles, 1 Kings chapter 22, and I'll tell you what I'm going to do different. You know, a message leads to it. You know, like we have a sermon that leads to a point. You're supposed to arrive at what we're trying to get you to think about at the end. I'm going to give it to you right up front. I'm going to tell you exactly what the message is. When I say the message, I'm talking about the theme, what I'm trying to get across. I'm going to give it to you up front and then just basically talk to you a little bit. But I want to talk to you guys about a man that changed my life a few years ago. You know, when you are young, you meet somebody along the way. I remember meeting people. I remember a guy when I was 21, a guy named Alex Dunlap. Alex Dunlap had a thing called the Conversion Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It was winning Roman Catholics to the Lord. He taught me, he said something, and it changed my life. He said, I learned, especially he knew where I went to school. And he wasn't hostile toward it. He said, I found out I can tell a person a lot of truth with a smile and still have a friend on the end of the line when I'm done. And that's, boom. It just changed things. And that happens a lot when you're young. I'm 66, about 3 years ago, maybe four. I had a conversation with a man. He didn't give me any advice. He didn't know what he was doing, but it altered everything. Kathy and I were one of those health guys. Guys, look, you know, I'm not a health nut as far as, put this magnet in your pocket and hang a clove of garlic around your neck and you'll never have another pain. I told Kathy one time, I said, I thought God knew everything, but He broke the neck of the dumbest guy on the planet because everybody knows how to take care of a broken neck except me. But what we were in for, she has shingles in her eye. I have some stuff I got in a doing traction. I had to do traction on the floor of a filthy motel that smelled like curry. And I got this stuff in my lungs and it's never gotten out. Never gotten out. So we went to this health guy. And he was going to help her eye, and he was going to help me breathe. And nothing succeeded. But we're staying here at this old house, old 1960s house. And this old man had moved next door with his son. And he was a saved guy, 86-year-old guy. And we just sat down and talked one day. And when we got done talking, it altered one of the major goals of my life. And I told her, I told Cab, I said, babe, I said, that guy changed my goal for life. And let me tell you what I used to say, guys. I used to say this. I used to look at Moses in Deuteronomy, and Moses said, I am 120 years old. Now, we know he had the force of a natural 20-year-old. He never got weak or anything like that. But he said, I can no longer go out or come in. And the reason was that he had done what God wanted him to do, correct? When he got done, you know, Lord said, you're not taking him across the Jordan, but this is as far as you're going, you're done. And I used to say this, the last day on the planet for me, whether it be today I'm going to die or today the Lord's going to come back, whichever that is, I'm not going to know, I assume, when those are, but I said, I would like to get up, and this is in my mind, take the lid off my spiritual job jar, reach in there to find out what is on the list. Anyway, reach in there and find out what I got to do and have it empty and say, man, I have done everything God wanted me to do. I am done. I can die. I no longer think that. I talk with this man. I can't remember what his occupation had been. He was, like I said, a saved guy, very nice man. He was a Korean War vet. Talked to me a little bit about that. Talked to me about what he did for his life. And I told Calf, I said, starting today, I said, when I die or the Lord comes back, I want some books that I am writing unfinished. I want some projects that never get done. And I'll tell you why that is. Because I realized, and guys, I am a pusher on what you heard Brother Sal talk about. You know, as you get older, have somebody ready to get that church turned over to. Now I know of five churches that have closed because the pastor never got ready. Four of those, the guy that started it, shut it down. I guess it was just the family business. And so I am a believer, you know, and like you heard, you don't retire from serving God, but the church is not yours. Your church is not yours. It is supposed to be the Lord's. And so I am a believer that there comes a time when you've got to be able to pass that on to somebody who can take that church farther. That doesn't mean that, you know, you go out to Arizona and buy a cave and live there. I find that very attractive. But here's what happens. When a man retires, you know what happens? All right, here's what he's doing before he retires. He goes to bed every night and he says, I got to get up tomorrow and I got to do that. And at the end of the day, he says, tomorrow I've got to do that. Even if it's I got to go to work, I've got to do that. And he keeps on going, correct? Then he retires. And he turns around and all he does now is tell you what he did. I don't mean in pride, okay? But he has no reason to see tomorrow's sunrise. He has closed it. I've done it. I'm done. This was my retirement. I'm finished. And there's no reason. So, you know, he ends up having like the nicest little flower garden on the block. But he has no reason to live. He has no reason to look forward to tomorrow's sunrise. So, but he wants you to know that his life has been worthy. And so he tells you what he did. And old men tell you what they did. And I said, babe, I said, I want more than I can do. I said, I want to leave something undone. I do not, because I want every night, I will have a reason to get up tomorrow morning. Okay? Now, with that 86-year-old man, let me tell you about another man. This guy, at that time, this guy was about 91 years old. My brother-in-law, Jeff Vaughn, knows him. His name is Wally Stuchel. Sidebar to this story. My dad worked at Republic Steel for 43 years. And I was witnessing to him when I got saved, you know, and I gave him a gospel tract one day. And he says, son, he said, I've gotten these for 30 years down at the mill. And I thought, well, praise the Lord, somebody's been going after my old man. So I'm at Canton Baptist Temple right after I got saved. And I was introduced to this guy named Wally Stuchel. Wally's just a little wiry guy. And he says, Gip. Sam Gipp? He said, are you John Gipp's son? I said, yeah. He goes, oh, man. He said, I've been witness to your dad for 30 years down at the mill. That's the guy that was giving the old man tracks. But let me tell you about Wally Stuchel. When he was 21 years old, he was in the Navy. He was a sailor on board the United States Ben Franklin, USS Ben Franklin aircraft carrier. I don't know if you realize it, but that is the most decorated ship in the naval history. And they were off the coast of the Philippines. They got hit by some Japanese. I don't think it was kamikaze. I think they got hit by bombs. Then the next day they got hit again. Blew, you know, back in those days, the aircraft carriers actually had the elevators right in the flight deck, not off to the side. Blew one of the elevators clear out of the thing, set the ship on fire, shut it all down. They lost their steam. Their boilers went down. It's listing. It's going to go over. They abandoned ship. The ship burnt for several days. But anyway, then engineering called the captain and he said, we've got one of the boilers up. We're making steam. Captain said, start the pumps. And those men fought that fire for 4 days. They got that thing back. They had abandoned ship. They got back on. They got the pumps. They got it righted. They made it into a port in Tuligay. Got some temporary repairs, and then went all the way down through the Panama Canal into New York Harbor. What they said when it cruised into New York Harbor, the thing was rust red because it burned all the paint off of it. But it was the most decorated ship in naval history. Wally Stuchel was on that ship. Wally Stuchel worked at Republic Steel. He retired from Republic Steel. Republic Steel isn't even there anymore. The thing is a parking lot. It's tore down. You know what Wally Stuchel's doing? This was at 91, but I can tell you he's about 92 or 3 today. You know what he's doing? I can tell you what he's doing right now. You know what he's doing? He's got an old pickup truck, and he runs all over town, Massillon, Canton, picking up scrap iron, scrap steel, that he redeems at some scrap steel place so that he can take the money and send inner-city kids to church camp. Now, I'm going to bring both these guys into this room with you. And this 86-year-old man, if you sat down and talked to him for 10, 15 minutes, you know what he'd do? He'd tell you, I was a Korean War vet. I used to work here. I did this. I did that. I did this. Then I want you to sit Wally Stutchel. And here's a guy who fought on the most decorated ship in the Navy. And when you got done talking to him for 15 minutes, you wouldn't even know it. He wouldn't bring it up. You know what he'd be talking about? Man, I think I can send more kids. I sent 138 last year, and I think I'm going to send more to youth camp this year. The man is retired from his job, but he has a reason to see tomorrow. You understand? Guys, if there's anything, I want a reason to wake up tomorrow. I always want to be looking. I always want to be looking into the future. I always want to look. And so that's my message. That's it. But I'm going to give you some illustrations because I got to burn up your time. Look at, or I'm sorry, did I say 2 Kings? It's 1 Kings. 1 Kings chapter 22. In 1 Kings chapter 22, there's a war going on. And this is an amazing thing. But it says this, look at verse 34. And a certain man, this is not a Jew, this is one of the Jews' enemies. And a certain man drew a bow at a venture. You know what that is? That is just, I don't know if I can do this or not. Let's just take a shot. Right? I mean, this is not a guy that says, oh man, this is in my range. I'm good at this. I'm going to tag this guy. You guys who go bow hunting, you know when that deer is right there and you got him dead to rights. And then some of them you go, well, that guy's a little beyond my range or maybe some branches in between us. I'm going to let him pass. But this is a war. And this guy, he's out of range. And he says, you know, I'm going to take a shot. Drew a bow at a venture. And smote the king of Israel between the joints of the harness. Wherefore, he said unto the driver of his chariot, turn thine hand and carry me out of the host, for I am wounded. And the battle increased that day, and the king was stayed up in the chariot against the Syrians. You know, Ahab was a wicked man. He was a great warrior. Ahab was one of the most wicked kings that Israel had, but this guy was, he was no wuss, brother. I mean, God says, hey, I'm going to have a bunch of the princes of the province. They're going to beat on these guys. And Ahab said, yeah, good, good. Who's going to lead you? And he goes, you are. And he did. And look, the guy just took an arrow square in the back and he didn't say, get me out. He said, help me up. And he stayed in the battle all day long. The battle increased that day and the king was stayed up in the chariot against the Syrians and died at even. And the blood ran out of the wound. Into the midst of the chariot, and there went a proclamation throughout the host about the going down of the sun, saying, every man to his city, and every man to his country. So the war ended. They all went home. The battle raged that day, but they went home. The war was over. You know why? Because the guy took a shot. It wasn't the perfect shot. You understand? It wasn't this one that this is my range. I've done this before. I can nail this guy. This is a little beyond my distance. In the Battle of the Adobe Walls, Bat Masterson was in that battle. And there were about, I'm going to guess, I think about eight Westerners there, Bat Masterson, a bunch of them. And the Indians had them around. And there was an Indian chief 1,000 yards out. And one guy says, let me try this. Now, I can't remember the guy's name. I've got it with a fight on books. This guy pops his sights up. And the Indians, they're out there 1,000 yards. They're not worried. And this guy takes his sights up. There's no 1,000-yard sight on his rifle. So he just kind of Kentucky windage and kind of, I think this ought to do it. And he squeezes this round off. And the guy goes, oh, you missed him. He goes, oh, wait a minute. You know, let's eat a sandwich. It's on its way. And all of a sudden, this chief goes, right backwards off the horse, and the Indians went, okay, I think we'll go home now. Just took a shot. And guys, what I'm going to tell you, first off, you know what I'm going to tell you? Quit fantasizing. I'm not talking about wicked fantasizing. I can't believe, you know what fantasizing is? And look, I know you've all had movies where you were the hero. And you've all built churches, you've all preached the message where everybody got right. And you've all built these great churches. But here's the problem, you spend all your time with this. I want to give you a thought, okay? Because you probably haven't had one. If some guy saw some woman walk by and go, "Wow, I fantasize about her," you'd go, "That's wicked, right?" Yeah, because you're fantasizing about a pro football player. "Well, but he's on my fantasy team." "Well, stay out of his fantasy shower room." But here's the problem, guys. You dream. You know, guys, you know what the difference between a visionary and a dreamer is? You ever this? We got a whole nation. "You need a dream. We need a dream." You know what a dreamer is? If a dreamer comes, if his dream comes true, he has some situation where he ends up being the hero and the most exalted person. In other words, if what he's dreaming about ever comes to a reality, he's going to be the greatest hero of all time. You know what a visionary is? If what he's thinking about comes true, everybody benefits. It was a visionary that gave us electric lights. It wasn't a dreamer. It was a visionary that gave us, a couple of visionaries that gave us the automobile and the airplane and so many of our inventions. It was somebody that said, "I think if I do this, it will help everybody." Do you understand? So it's not bad to be a visionary. It is, but you're wasting time if you're going to be a dreamer. You know, you're going to run the greatest turn. You're going to intercept the ball and run it backwards, doing backflips and cartwheels over top of that. You know, I had a guy tell me this about football one time. He said, "Football comes right down to this. Block and tackle." Guys, I love the game of football. I don't understand the positions. I know center and quarterback. And after that, you know, I played end guard and tackle. Sat at the end of the bench, guarded the water bucket, and tackled anybody come near it. And I don't know what they. "Well, that guy is a wide end." I don't know what a wide end is. You say, "Well, why don't you know that?" I don't care. But I know this. If every guy that was supposed to block hit his assignment right, it's all over. Nobody's getting past him, right? And if every guy, how many times do you see a missed tackle? If there was never a missed tackle, play ends right there. Isn't that true? In other words, don't get this crazy fantasy about, "I'm going to do this great thing." Block and tackle. I know what you want. You want to be the guy that goes to bat, you know, last of the ninth, two outs, bases loaded, you're down by three, and you're going to hit the grand slam home run. What if you were the head of a baseball team and you had a guy never hit a double in his career, never hit a triple, and never hit a home run? Oh, worthless. But every time at bat, hit a single. I mean, every single time. Would that not be the most valuable player? Guys, I don't even want to be the most valuable player. I really don't. I don't want to be the most valuable player. I take that most out. I just want to be a valuable player. Whenever I play sandlot ball, everybody want to play quarterback, I want to block. I just want to hit a guy. And so, first off, quit spending your time out here with this grand fantasy of what you're going to do and try something. Now, I'm going to tell you the two words that Americans have become absolutely, we're terrified of these two words. Loser, failure. Now, I like losers. You know what a loser is? If somebody tried. That beats sitting home fantasizing. You know, I use this illustration. Two guys get in the ring. One guy gets in. He says, I'm gonna take the heavyweight belt from the champ. And he gets in this ring and goes 15 rounds or 12 rounds or whatever it is. And I mean, it is, they're both just barely standing. And he loses the fight by a split decision. That's about as close as you can come and still lose, isn't it? And everybody in the arena goes, "He's a loser." And I think, loser? He can whip every other man in the building. Anybody want to jump in? Probably after the 12 rounds, he'll still take you out. Right? I'm going to tell you, I don't even have a name. I guess the name, it doesn't bring enough shame with it. Spectator. Because the loser got in the ring, took a beating, and tried something, and the spectator sat on the front row and never would get in the ring and never does anything, and then waxes eloquent on how the guy should have done something to win the fight. And we are Americans and we are great at being spectators, but guys, try something. I want to do something. All right? I am driven. I mean, I got to do something. I don't want to mark time. I don't want my energy expended for nothing. You know, one of the things I just point out, my old man was a worker. Never did this. You know what that is? That's called twiddling your thumbs. You're expending energy and accomplishing nothing. Right? We have a young generation. They don't do this either. They do this. Say, what is that? That's expending energy and accomplishing nothing. I mean, if your grand goal of life is three letters on a pinball machine in a restaurant somewhere, or you reach level 24 on a computer game, it is time to grow up. And so I'm going to tell you something. I'm just going to look. The reason some of you guys won't try is because you're afraid you'll fail. So what's wrong with failing? Do you know what WD-40 is? Do you know why it's called WD-40? Does anybody know what the WD is? WD, water dispensing. That's what it does. Yeah, you can spray it. We used to have distributor caps and you get moisture underneath them. You take WD-40, shoot it up in there because it dissipates water. Do you know why it's called 40? Because they tried 39 formulas before they got the one that worked. 39 failures before the thing worked. Somebody said Edison tried 280 some times to make an electric bulb. I wouldn't have tried that many times. I'm sorry. But boy, what I'm saying is that if it were me, we'd be sitting here by candlelight and it wouldn't be romantic. For sure with you guys it wouldn't be romantic. Except maybe you fantasy football guys. Anyway, And you know what some of you guys got? You even have some ideas, maybe something to do something for your church. I'm not talking about going contemporary, because I'm certainly not into that. But what I'm saying is that there may be something you can do, but you're afraid to try because you fail, and then somebody will say you failed. Guys, I can tell you about failing, man. I mean, I can tell you how to lose tens of thousands of dollars writing books and finally you just give them away. Let me give you an example. I got tired of something. You know what I got tired of? I got tired of parents coming up to me and saying, we sent our son or our daughter to a King James, Bible-believing Bible college. And I've heard this more times than I can count. And they came back and said, and they went to this King James school, and the first thing they heard was the italics don't belong there. The archaic words need to be changed. King James homosexual. Easter's mistranslation. I have had pastors tell me, I have had parents tell me, we sent this child to a King James Bible college. They came back and called us a heretic and no longer go to the church here. Okay, so you think that's terrible? I think it's terrible. Okay, so don't we think a lot of things are terrible? Guys, you can think a lot of things are terrible. That's not the big deal. The big deal is, what are you going to do about it? Well, I can't do anything about it. But no, you're playing fantasy football. You're wasting your energy. You're wasting your time. And so I said, there's got to be something I do. We came up with Valiant for the Truth. 2 years, we get them grades 11 and grades 12. I can't tell you how many times I've had people now, young people, come to me and say, in my King James Bible College, my professor got up and said this. There was wrong with the King James Bible. And I just went back to my lessons. And I said, nope, I got that answer before I ever went in. All I'm telling you guys is there may be, and I'm not into power positive thinking, okay? I don't believe there's a champion in all of you. Because I am sure some of yours, you left the barn door open and the champion escaped. But But here's the problem. There are potential successes sitting at the tables here for things that you could do that next year at the next pastor's school, or maybe 2 or 3 years down the line, it's such a success, you'll be up here telling people how to do it because you actually tried it, instead of saying, oh, you know, if we fail, you'll fail. Doesn't the Bible say? Doesn't the Bible doesn't say a righteous man never falls down. What does it say? Yeah, I mean, he fell down 7 times. My goodness, man. You imagine ice skating and falling down 7 times, you get up and be a world champ. Isn't that true? You know, I'm not. I think the skiers, any guys ski? You ever fall down? Oh, I went out, I fell down, and I put the skis in the car and I came home. I don't want to be called a faller downer. What I'm telling you, you go, so-and-so, they're a great person. If they're great, they're only great because they didn't worry about failing. They didn't worry about being called a loser. They saw something that needed done, and they wanted it done. And, you know, we've done some things. We got the posters. They're just a little thing. But I say it's better than a stupid, dope-headed football player in some teenage kid's wall, don't you think? I think that comes out better. Our bumper stickers. You say, well, I know people got bumper stickers. Yeah, most of them are Scripture. Scripture been done. I mean, somebody said, why didn't you do Scripture bumper stickers? I said, because unless I do the NIV, it's not going to be really a first time. Right? I mean, you can get the Scripture. Just, you say, well, it makes people mad. I hope it intimidates some bad people into shutting up. Look, I'll just give you one real good positive sidebar. You may want to go buy a bumper sticker. I came into a church and this lady came up and she said, I got pulled over by a cop. And she said, I was speeding or something. And he said, lady, you were speeding and I ought to give you a ticket. But I like your bumper sticker, so I'm giving you a warning. So when I'm in a church, I tell that story and I say, now, so for just $1... It saves the speeding lawyer that you saw on the billboard. Now here's the problem. some of the things you do, they will be successes. Dying for the Truth has been a success. And the posters, for whatever they're worth. We Are Americans has been one of the greatest flops I've ever had. So I really like that. You know, I did that. I did that when George Bush won his second term, 2004. I did that with express purpose. I wanted to put all the American history I could in one little pamphlet. And the goal of that was to influence the 2008 election so that we got a good president. You know who we got in 2008? A Muslim. A Kenyan. A communist. Right? Now, so guys, that was a failure. And it was, I mean, there's some bucks in that. Okay? Now you say, well, I still like it. Well, you can like it. But the fact is that the goal I was aiming at, I spent over $30,000 on that. How'd you like to waste that kind of money? Wouldn't I like it? Well, okay, so go like it. I had one guy, you know, he didn't like me selling them. So he says, you know, could I have permission just maybe make some copies? I said, sure. He said, well, I might make a bunch of copies. I know he's thinking he's going to reprint it. He never did it. You know why? Because then he found out what it was going to cost him to print it. But I'm telling you, guys, just try something. Publishing company, I just found out this week. I walked over the table and I'm standing there talking to somebody. I said, well, we got a new book. I said, we got 2 new books. And we published for about 20-some guys. And I wrote I've written the authors and I tell them, I said, look, if you think that here's what everybody thinks. You're going to write a book. And you're going to give it to a publishing company. They're going to go, oh, this is the greatest thing on this subject ever written. We are going to publish this for you, and we're going to pay you royalties. We will be dumping truckloads of money in your yard starting this month. And every month for the rest of your life, you get a $10,000 check. Yeah, that ranks right up there with fantasy football. I'm going to give you 2 words. They're somewhat associated. Tide. Tsunami. You think that you're going to put the money out like the tide and it's going to come in like a tsunami? it goes out like a tsunami. You say, what do you mean? I mean, you dump $5,000, $10,000. Yeah, but look, you spent $5,000 to print that, and judging from the price, when it's sold, you're going to make $20,000 over 20 years. I got some books I may give you. Now that I think of it, we just got some there. Hey, look, Understandable History and Answer Book have been printed, I think Understandable History has been printed 10 times. Answer Book is, it's the Answer Book, 10 times. Understandable History has been about, I think, 7. And I'm reprinting another. Most of the books haven't been reprinted. Pick them up and look at the copyright date. You go back clear to the 90s, early 90s. I dump maybe $5,000 or $6,000. You say, you must have a lot of money. No, all the book money goes into an account to print books. That account gets money. I wouldn't rob it. Anyway, and so you throw $5,000 out and you print a book, and then it comes in over, how about since 1990? What does $25,000 mean if it comes in? You've been getting it in increments since 1990. It ain't that much, is it? It goes out like a tsunami. It comes in like the tide. So then why you write the books? Never did do it to get money. Try to do something to help. And that is why Brother Stauffer writes his books. It doesn't really work, but... I'll tell you what I had. The 24-hour century, 24-hour King James seminar. You know how that happened? A guy out of nowhere, never heard this guy. He's a pastor in Virginia. And he said, I'd like you to come. You're going to be in the area. And I said, man, I got a Sunday through Wednesday. And I said, the next week, Sunday through Wednesday. Next day, Sunday through Wednesday. Next day, Sunday through Wednesday. I said, I don't have any time. He said, well, would you come on Thursday? I said, do you have Thursday night service? He said, we will. I said, well, let me see how far I have to drive. And I looked and I said, I got to drive 250 miles from the Wednesday finish to the next meeting. That's a piece of cake. I said, I can give you Thursday and Friday. He said, okay, I want you to teach on the King James Bible for 12 hours a day for 2 days. You say, what did you think? I thought, wonder if I can do that. Now, this should only be a colossal failure if I can't. But I said, I wonder if I can. I don't mean, do I have the material? I knew the material was there. But I said, we're going to find out. We got up Thursday and Friday, taught for 24 hours, 12 hours a day for 2 days. And I saw that guy a couple of years ago. He might have come over here. It might have been 2 years ago here. And he said, my church has never been the same. He said, my people are reading their Bibles. He said, they are in their Bible. He said, my entire church made a change. And then we did the one here. Now, you say, oh, then that's been a success. No. No, and I like doing it. It takes me 3 days to walk right after I do that. Well, you can laugh. You stand up for 24 hours and see how you do. But, I'm going to tell you guys, after I did it, I thought, I had this thing in the back of my mind. And the thing in the back of my mind was this. Someday, I'm not going to be able to travel like this. And so, what do you do? And I told Kathy, I said, if we can do 24-hour King James seminars, because we charge for them, but you got to have $5,000. You got to make $5,000 on one to just cover the cost. And I said, maybe, if we have to come off the road because of my health or something, I can stand up for 2 days and we can make enough to live on above the cost. You say, well, what happened? The loving brethren that put them on the internet. Yeah, look, there. My stuff is all over the internet and it's free. That's the only thing I say, keep off the internet. And the guy that runs my publishing company called me one day and he said, I just got a strange phone call. What? What you get, the 24-hour seminar out there, it's got 12 DVDs of 30-some lessons. Then it's got another CD that is the entire thing on MP3. Then it's got another CD that is a 130-page syllabus. And he said, I just got a call. Some guy said, I want to just buy the syllabus. And the guy said, why don't you buy the whole set? Well, I'm getting it free off the internet. I just need the syllabus. And so I went on the internet. There it is. So you know what happened? The next King James seminar had 3 people register for it. So I got a guy that worked in Navy security, internet security. And I called him up and I said, can you take care of this? And this man now knows where Jimmy Hoffa is. Anyway, he took a site down in this country. He took one down in Europe. I get an email from this. You know where it was? It was on a site called a pirate site. So don't tell me, was this somebody trying to help the ring? He knew exactly what he was doing. I'll tell you exactly what he was doing. The rich evangelist, God gave him that, and then he's charging you for it. He's just a money grubber, so I'm going to put it on free so you don't have to give him any money. Who do you think you are? I had somebody tell me that one time. I said, why do you charge for your books? God gave it to you free. I said, well, if God knew it was going to be a money grubber, why didn't he give it to you? Well, if you think it ought to be free, why did he give it to you? And so I get this, and he wouldn't even put his name on there, and he said, you could have contacted me. You took my whole website down. And I said, I didn't know how to contact you. I said, you take a man's life's work and you put it on the internet for free. I said, got no business. He wrote back, I think I've got him down. He said, I said, you stole a man's life's work and put it on the internet. He said, well, you stole it from God because he knows everything. Somehow I think this kid rides a bike. But the problem is, it's been on again. We took it down again. I just had him take it down a third time. We're going to lose that battle. We're going to lose that battle. But it gets the job done. Let me tell you about a pastor. He was pastoring in Indiana. A thought he had. He had a thought of, how he got them doing this, of having on his church property competitions between fire companies. First responding fire companies. He would buy a trailer and he'd take a wall off of it. And then they'd hide a mannequin somewhere in her bed or something. And then they would have these guys, he would have them compete. And it got so popular that it became a required part of the training. In other words, these guys were getting training credit for going through this. And he had tremendous outreach in his area. And what I'm saying is that why don't you find something that nobody's doing? Why don't you think of something? Why don't you give some a shot? I don't know if you thought about this. You know, during the first Gulf War, we dropped World War I artillery barrels from our planes. We did. Yeah. During the first Gulf War, Saddam Hussein had bunkers that were buried underground so far that nothing we had would penetrate down far enough, let alone go through the concrete. The concrete roof. And this is why I like Americans, brother. Americans are always, hey, I think we can do this. Let's try this. And somebody said, you know, we've got a bunch of World War I artillery barrels in storage that are never going to be used. Why don't we make them bombs? They didn't make them bombs. They made them smart bombs. They only ever dropped 2 in testing. The first one, I can't remember how far it went. The second one went 100 feet underground. They've never retrieved it. They poured this, I think it's called Trinitin, the explosive. It's a liquid. It's actually like a slurry. It's heated, and then they pour it into the bomb. They said they were still warm when they were putting them on the plane, and they took them right off the planes and blew up all of his bunkers. Now, can you imagine some guy going, well, you know, I think maybe we could use those artillery barrels. We could make them smart bombs. Oh, they'll laugh at me if I say that. And what if it doesn't work? But the guy, he just gave it a shot. Oh, I'm telling you guys, what I'm telling you, why don't you shoot at a venture? That's all I'm saying. Why don't you pull back an arrow, take something that's out of your league, that's out of your range. Think about this. You know, I got to tell you about this kid, Danny, smart mouth kid I used to build houses with. He was. He was one of those kind of guys, like, every morning, like, no matter what he said, you could hear him saying, here's what he actually was saying. Bet you can't hit me in the mouth, please. And he comes in at work one day, and he's got a Band-Aid right here. I said, we're having lunch. I said, Danny, what happened to your lip?
Oh, man. I said something over the weekend to some guy, and he punched me in the mouth.
I wanted to be there. Anyway, but then he says this.
But when he pulled his fist back, his knuckles were bleeding.
I said, whoa, Danny, he fell into your cunningly devised trap. I said, you were going to hit him continually in the fist with your face, strategically biting his knuckles until he was weak from loss of blood, and then you were going to spring. Guys, you know what you don't want to do? Look, if you want to fight somebody, let me tell you to fight. A giant. You say, we can't win. Yeah, but if you do. You know what you don't want? You don't want to come in with your arm in a sling and a bandage on your head. So what happened to you last weekend? Got in a fight. With who?
Midget.
Oh, that's awful. No, what's awful is he was drunk. And he only had one arm. I mean, don't, if you come in that way, don't you say,
giant.
I mean, he was big. He was about 14 feet tall. So, don't feel bad, man. Everybody expects you to lose to a giant. I went to the drag races one time, and I saw this 84 Corvette. He lined up against this Ford and got beat. This Ford truck. Four-door. Dually. All-wheel drive. Diesel. My son and I, I'm watching this. This truck goes, boom. I said, son, a lesson of life. The man who owns that Corvette, if he goes home today and hangs himself, it's a completely honorable thing to do. You say, oh, you're watching that truck beat that Corvette. No, I was not. You know what I was thinking about? I was thinking about him. Don't you know what happened when he went to work Monday? Hey, Bill, did you go racing like said?
Yeah, I went.
Oh, must not have won, huh?
No, I ran.
What beat you?
Ford.
Oh, Mustang Shelby, huh?
No.
Cobra.
No. It was a diesel truck.
Guys, if you got a Corvette, race a Ferrari. Don't expect you to lose a win to a Ferrari. See, the guy in the truck had it made. It was a win-win. If he lost, you go, yeah, man, but I got a diesel truck and I was racing a Corvette. And if he wins, I'll bet he's still talking about it.
I'll tell you, I don't left my truck. I'll beat a Corvette.
Guys, what I'm telling you is, take a shot. You will not always win. You will not always win. And the losses can be costly. The Living with Pain book, when I did that, and some of this I think is probably, you know, I don't want to say satanically coordinated, but when two or three things happen all at the same time and converge, not for a storm, but for a perfect storm, there's something going on. But the Living with Pain book, I sent it to my proofreader. He was my cover man and my proofreader. Right at the time, his church was going contemporary. I didn't know it. And because he was going contemporary and he didn't like my stand, he didn't proofread it. He sent it back to me with the typos in it. And so that's bad. Oh, no. That's not bad. Because there's always typos. I got mine proofread three times. I could get a book printed today, open it, I pick the first book out of the box, open it up, and find a typo. And I find typos in anti-King James guys' books. When guys complain about your typos, that means they got no complaint. So that doesn't bother me. But what coordinated with this was that the guy at that time that was running my book company said, we're going to work to get you on mainstream Christian bookstores, and I've got it. It's all secured. Now, I print about 5,000 books at a time. You know, most people, the average is about 2,500. If you sell 5,000 books of a book, you've sold a lot. Now, I know what you're thinking. Well, I see Tom Clancy. Well, that kind of junk. Yeah, you can sell a million of those. But I'm talking about real books. And this guy said, you better print 25,000. 25,000 books. Guys, at $1 a piece, that's a lot of money. We've never recovered from that. Because the guy never did do that. He just said he was. He took the money and ran. I printed 25,000 books with typos. And this guy never opened the doors he said he's going to open. So what do? You get back up. You know what the book says? Don't you get back up? The second edition of the Understandable History, it looks like this one. It's this size, only that blue center, the whole thing was blue. Nobody did me wrong on that book. But we had three things that happened on that. The guy that was proofreading for me at that time was teaching English literature in a University of Mississippi, I believe, which should have told me something. But anyway, and he corrected it and then sent me the original instead of the corrected copy, and it went out with typos. But not only that, but I just got a new computer and I didn't understand about fonts. And so the font, when I had it printed, the fonts were different than when I originally did it. So all the page numbers came out different. The whole typesetting was thrown off. And so it was all messed up and none of the index numbers were right. Well, I mean, like page 1 was okay. Page 5 might be okay. 10 was probably page 11. And page 400 was page 781. I mean, they were gone. Plus, Jack Chick, they bought 300 of them. Right off the press, and he called me and he said, Sam, I picked up your book, I opened it up, and the pages exploded. Because the guy that was doing the binding, he had to do $4,000 worth of work to his binder. Now, I'm going to tell you what that man did, and I'll tell you who that was Shelbyville. They drove from Tennessee all the way to Cleveland, Ohio, that's where we were located at that time, took every book, took it back to Shelbyville, reprinted new covers, ground the bindings off, recovered them, recut them, and shipped them all back up at their cost, which is what they should have done. They were very honorable. But, man, that ended that. And what I'm saying is, you say, does that get to you? Oh, no, I knew it gets to me. Treachery. I have one. I cannot tell you what it was. I can't tell you who did this. This was a friend. You say, former friend? Friend today. A friend today who torpedoed me on getting something printed. Yeah. How about 200 pieces? No, 200,000. 200,000 pieces we had printed. And that was the day. I got to tell you the truth. When that happened, I was storming. I was storming back and forth in that RV. The whole length of it. Then I went across. I was raging. I was raging, brother, because this guy, I cannot tell you what he did, but he knew what he did, and he torpedoed me. And I'm screaming at, and I don't scream, but I screamed to my wife, not at her. I said, if I was a quitter, today is the day I would quit. I came that close to shutting the entire public company down. I was fed up with it. So what do? Still open. We're still printing books. Got two new ones on the table this week. Guys, you're gonna get shafted by the brethren. Yeah. So, well, is that guy your enemy? No, I said he's my friend. Still my friend. You ever talk to him about it? Nope. I'm not gonna talk to him about it. Just never gonna trust him again. But he's still my friend. He really is. And I'll help him if he needs help. But what I'm telling you guys, don't we say we're in a war? Well, you're going to have to get wounded a little bit. But what do? You get back up and you keep going. me tell you these and I'll be done. I got a story, I think it's in the first Fight On book, might be the second one. This guy was a prospector. And he was going into town. He's in California, it's 1800s. And he's going into town, he stepped off the trail to a little point, you know, and he's 1,000 feet down to the American River. And he was there's a tree here and a big rock, and he goes out here and he's standing at the point of this and he's looking at it, and he hears something behind him, he turns around, and maybe from here to that table is a grizzly bear. I mean, that is the only way out. He's a dead man, do you understand? The grizzly bear's got him cut off. He can jump, but he's going to die one way or another. Now, when you know you're going to die, there's got to be some advantage. Like, I can't really mess this up. I mean, when a grizzly bear is going to attack, it really doesn't matter if you sing to him or call him names. He's still going to eat your face. But you say, here's what he said. He said, well, I thought that I should face death like a Christian. He said, well, then he prayed. Yeah, yeah. Why me? Why me? Anyway, so he said, I picked up a rock to throw it. You try throwing a rock at a bear, they don't stop when they get hit by 45 shells. And he said, I threw this rock, and it went, and got lodged in the bear's throat. He said, the bear came down on all fours. I still couldn't get past him. He said, I jumped on his back and leaped up to a limb that I couldn't have reached without him. Thank you, Mr. Bear. He said, I'm climbing on this limb, and he said, this thing is dancing, jumping, thrashing, finally rolled off the cliff. So he goes into town. His town wasn't far, and he's telling these people, you're going to believe what just happened, and they didn't. But somebody said, well, if it really happened, the bear ought to be there. The whole town went out to the foot of the cliff. There's the bear. There was the rock. So what happened? Took a shot. You know, General George Washington, during our revolution, you know what he did? The redcoats were in Boston. And he surrounded Boston with his artillery. And he sent word down to the British general, my artillery are on the hills surrounding. We have got you. And you know what the Brits did? They evacuated Boston. They didn't know Washington didn't have any shells. He had no shells for his ammunition. He had no ammunition for his guns. He said, well, let's give this a try. I mean, they can't any more than charge up the hill and kill us. Had they charged up the hill, they'd have killed them. But they saw the guns, said, we can't win. Let's get on the boats and leave. Took a shot. I know of a case where a man who was an archer in a war at a venture took a shot and ended the war that day. Let me tell you this. World War II, you know what they called, what our guys called Sherman tanks? Zippos. You know why? Because they were gasoline powered. When they got hit, they just exploded. The gasoline was much more volatile than diesel fuel, and they just blew up. And after the invasion at Normandy, there was a Sherman tank got caught in the flats by a Tiger. That was bigger. That was the Tiger tank. The 76-millimeter gun on a Sherman would literally be like a BB off this wall. There's nothing, there's not anything on that Tiger that it can penetrate. And this Tiger came out here and saw that Sherman and stopped. And the turret began to traverse 15 degrees or 90 degrees and take a shot and knock that Sherman out. And the captain, the commander of that tank, yelled to his gunner, shoot him! And the gunner says, sir, it'll bounce off. Take the shot! Sir, nothing we have will penetrate it. And they're watching. They're watching death. And he said, take the shot! The last thing they were going to do is spit one last round and bounce it off this thing before they died. And so the gunner, knowing it wasn't going to do a bit of good, let the round go, and it jammed right between the turret and the hull, and the turret went. guy in that tank, my uncle, George Gipp, lived because of that. He said, I learned a Sherman. I never knew a Sherman could go backwards that fast. He said, we didn't turn around. He said, I mean, that driver threw it in reverse. And we just, he said, we got over a hill, turned around, and got out of Dodge. See what I'm saying? You know why some things are impossible? Because you think they're impossible. Keep this in mind. If you want to do something, you'll find a way. If you don't want to, you'll find an excuse. Let's have a word of prayer. Thank you, God, that we could be here. Thank you, Lord, that we as men could be in the ministry. Father, that you would allow us to preach for you, God, that you would just be so kind. Lord, I ask you that maybe something said here. Well, I don't just encourage these guys to stay in the ministry. I want them to find new ground. God, my desire has always been to find some area that we were not and go there. And help every one of these men to look around their area. Someplace where they have not been. I think somebody mentioned earlier about police chaplains. Who knows, God? There's something these guys can do. They can't just sit around and dream about being a success at anything. They don't have to fantasize about being a success and a hero. They need to find an area where they are not, where they can have a presence. And maybe they will fail. Then help them get back up and help them go back at it again. And God, maybe they could stop an entire war at a venture. It's already been done. It could be done again. In Jesus' name, thank you.